to Hermetic America 9, and we're going to have to get a little esoteric today to understand something about American history and why it is really a hermetic American history. In 1969, right about the time when my graduate alma mater, San Francisco State, was completely closed down because of massive student demonstrations, I was selected as the only graduate out of 19,000 students because I was held as an exemplar of the kind of involvement in transformative education at the time. Because I had been the prize teaching assistant at San Francisco State, I was given the opportunity to design courses that would be run at the university. The first course that I offered in the spring of 1966 was on the Hermetic Renaissance, how the rediscovery in the Renaissance of the great Hermetic distillation of the Platonic and Neoplatonic traditions was formative in bringing the arts and sciences back into learning, so that a medieval university like the University of Paris or the University of Oxford, which were clerical training grounds for Aristotelian hierarchies of clergy and occasionally people in medicine, was obviated in the Renaissance by a new kind of university that featured the arts and sciences together, and that they were arranged in resonances of colleges, and that the colleges together constituted a university which was able to go back and recapture the classical learning and bring it into play again, stepped up in energy so that there was a new spirit in the world. In his great pioneering television series, Civilization, Sir Kenneth Clark, who pioneered the 13-part film series directed by Adrian Malone in the 1960s, said of the Renaissance that it seems that at times the earth is a little warmer than usual and man a little freer than usual, and at this time, the Renaissance opened up the medieval blinders of authority and limited opportunity to a new scaler, and that was of a Renaissance man who would be able to expand the scale of his applications through the arts and sciences to be able to bring back into play the great man who makes history instead of the great institutions that control authority, that direct the development of doctrines which then shape what used to be called history but really isn't history. What is shaped is the ritual basis of mythology. One of the deepest thinkers of the Hermetic Renaissance was Machiavelli, who was famous for all time for writing his little monograph, The Prince. The Prince being the principal, the first, the head man of the empire, and the first effective prince on a world scale was Augustus Caesar, and he called his empire not the Roman Empire, but he called it the Principate, and that he himself was only the first man. He was the princeps, and that while you could say what you liked about anything in true Roman Republic freedom, you would have to hear him first and then decide what it was you were going to say vis-a-vis what you had heard from the head, the emperor of the world. When Napoleon came into power, he did not call himself by fancy names. He said that he was the first consul to be heard, and that everyone else could decide for themselves what they were able to say. And in this way, the Napoleonic era brought back the Roman Empire ethos in spades. And it came right on the heels of the French Revolution, which came on the heels of the American Revolution, which was the culmination of the Renaissance. A late culmination of the Renaissance. And for that, we have to understand the shapes and patterns of history. It has a great deal to do with the origins of Christianity as a world order in the making, and the teachings of Jesus, which essentially were not a Christianity, but originally were called the Way. He said of himself, "I am the truth and the way." The distinction between the teachings of Jesus and the doctrines of a Christian church structure, the Holy Roman Church, became an issue in the Napoleonic era, highlighted by Thomas Jefferson, who took a scissors and paste to the New Testament and cut out the words of Jesus and put them together without any kind of context or emendation, and passed out copies of what was called the Jefferson Bible to all of the members of Congress. He called it the philosophy of Jesus later on. And the emphasis was that we are ourselves awakened to a resonance of the man and his transcendent qualities of understanding, which are a guide signal for us, which were a expanding symbol for us, and that we as persons freed from the constraints of imposed authority have the freedom to explore this, the liberty to practice it, and the joys of life to have, as the saying in the New Testament was in the letter to the Hebrews, to run the course with endurance. One of the things in American history which suffered an eclipse during the Great Depression was the Chautauqua and Lyceum circuits. This volume, a collection, I brought a copy of it, came out in 1969. It came out exactly at the time where I was chosen to be the only graduate of San Francisco State at that time. Not only did I offer courses on the Hermetic Renaissance, one of my courses was called Job and Faust, Two Faces of Evil. Another was a course on the cosmology of Teilhard de Chardin, the budding of a new quality of man reaching towards an omega point of opening, a new seeding of possibility, a seeding that comes not just out of a biosphere, but comes out of a new sphere, N-O-O, from the Greek N-O-U-S, mind, that the earth has layers of geology, biology, and a pneumatic layer of the higher kinesthetic spiritual expanses, and that man is ready to take root, finally, and reach out with this extra dimension to regain his home in the stars, in heaven, in actuality. The book on the Chautauqua circuits in the Lyceums, published in 1969, had a quote at the beginning, "The most American thing in America, the Chautauquas, Theodore Roosevelt." And the little dots on the American continental mass show the locations of Lyceums and Chautauquas, and in 1923, 40 million Americans were attending Chautauqua circuit lectures, and the figure is in 10,000 different communities across the land. This Chautauqua circuit Lyceum focus was due to a transformation of the sermons in early American churches, highlighted, as we have been looking at for several weeks, by Jonathan Edwards, and today taking Edwards a giant step forward of Ralph Waldo Emerson. The sermons of Jonathan Edwards, this beautiful reader put out by Yale University Press, I believe, 1999, indexes what are now, by now, 25 volumes of the collected works of Jonathan Edwards. The sermons are so numerous, and they go from his early days, he was born in 1703, to 1750, when he was locked out of his church and sent off in shamed exile to be a teacher at an Indian school, a great reduction from being one of the star sermon deliverers in the world at the time. He was the exemplar of the American of the Great Awakening. And in this volume 22 of the works of Jonathan Edwards, the opening of this sermon, which I'm going to just give you a few sentences from, is headlined, "They Sang a New Song." And the first couple of sentences read, "The Great Awakening was preeminently about the new birth, a dramatic spiritual movement when the individual, despairing of personal ability to effect forgiveness of sins and salvation, completely surrendered his or her soul to Christ. While Edwards' preaching often dwelt on the horrors and suffering of eternal damnation, this was not what made the revivals new to him. What was new was the new birth, and Edwards' reflections on this brought forth some of his most powerful and evocative sermons." He headlines, "They Sing a New Song," this sermon, with a quotation from the Apocalypse by St. John. that closes out the New Testament, that closes out the standard traditional Bible. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth, Revelations 14:3. In a sermon, December 1740, 10 years before he was finally locked out of his church, he used typology to issue both an appointed warning and an exhortation to his flock, like the Israelites of old under David, the inhabitants of Northampton, Massachusetts, had enjoyed in the past special tokens and privileges of God's presence, but they have incurred God's anger and caused his departure because of their errors. Using the biblical account of the return of the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, in First Chronicles 15, Edwards warns his people not to abuse the new outpouring of God's Spirit. What became characteristic was that by 1750, when he was locked out, the Great Awakening, the Puritan base of what had been colonial America since the early 1600s, the early 17th century, came to a close, as if there were a time form trigger, and the very next New Year, 1751, Franklin's letters on electricity were published in London and quickly translated into many European languages, and it was a watershed, it was a threshold where before 1751, all of the streams led back into a Protestant tussle with Roman Catholicism for the right spirit of Christianity. And after that, there was an increasing realization that before there was a Christianity, either Roman or Protestant, there was a way of Jesus that was available personally without any kind of authority or structure. And that new structures could be made. And the largest new structure that was made was the United States. That it was based not only on a separation of church and state, it was based upon a personal community and civilization who were self-reliant and came together in their self-reliantness and did not owe allegiance to either church or state, that the state was dependent upon the people in their shared self-reliance, and that the freedom of religion was the freedom also not to have even just a Christianity, but to have an individual understanding and assessment of one's relationship to the divine, of one's questing to try to discern what the divine might be. The quality of Emerson is extraordinary in that he was raised literally to be one of the great ministers. And by the time he was 23, he was appointed as the minister in Boston of the Second Church, one of the great structures at the time. And he was the giver of the sermons there at the apex of Boston Puritan conservative American ideals for 6 years, from 1826 to 1832, when he resigned his pulpit And in resigning his pulpit, he withdrew permanently and critically from all assumed religious or political ready-made institutions. He rejected outright and across the board that ready-made doctrines, ready-made institutions of whatever nature, church or state, were blinders of a medieval mentality creeping back in like an undertow, and that what was needed was a new expansiveness. And very soon, within a couple of years, Emerson published one of the archetypal Hermetic American books simply called Nature. And we'll look closer at Nature next week. Nature is the first positing of what a green ecology would be from the mysteriousness of the origins of every human person. And this became characterized as a movement, as an ism, as transcendentalism. The vehicle that expressed transcendentalism most cogently and clearly was a publication called The Dial. And The Dial was a magazine for the first 4 years, from 1840 to 1844, actually about a five-year span, was edited by Emerson and the very young Thoreau and one of the most extraordinary Hermetic women, Margaret Fuller. Margaret Fuller, who we will take a look at next week as well, deeper. This is a portrait of her as a younger woman. This is her as a more mature woman. She married an Italian man named Ossoli, and when she was coming back from Europe, her ship sank and all hands were lost. She was drowned within sight of the shores of Massachusetts. But the endearing and enduring contribution of Margaret Fuller and Emerson and Thoreau in The Dial was sending out resonances, and one of the more notable resonances was in the New American Midwest, a publication called The Western Messenger, The Western Mercury, The Western Hermes, that what had been a seaboard Hermetic America was beginning to now jump over the Appalachians into the American Midwest in the 1830s and conspicuous by the early 1840s. And right on the heels of the first 5 or 6 years of The Dial and some of the issues of the Western Messenger, Herman Melville published his first great book, Typee, of an American who was a part of the American ship running global network, who had leapt ship with his good pal Toby, and that Melville and Toby had lived for some years with the cannibal savages of a South Seas island and discovered more humanity in the cannibals than they had ever found in the so-called culture or communities of the so-called civilized world. Part of this was an astonishing aspect that triggered a harmonic in the form of an archetype that there must then be a real paradise on earth, untouched by the contamination of an authoritarian system that kept reinfecting man, and that if one could only get to the South Seas paradise, you could recapture the primordial goodness of our being. Melville, of course, was followed by people like Gauguin and many others to try to find that South Seas paradise. The musical South Pacific has echoes still in the 1950s of that tone. But most of the emphasis was that it would take experimental communities. It would take small groups of Americans to form utopian communities where they could come together and they could rediscover the primordiality of themselves. All of these are archetypal. All of these are deeply symbolic. All of these have a visionary field of transform operative. All of them present a different scalar of the person from the individual, and that the individual matures to the person through the field of a visionary awakening, of a taking out of the limitations of form that mentality through doctrines, that ritual through inculcation, trapped in a mythological pressure, and that it was the mythological trapped pressure that produced the violence, that produced the anxiety, that produced the anger, that also produced the desperate yearning for something different, something new, something other, and that whatever it took to break through, either on the ritual inculcation side or the symbolic limited mentality side, that this was to be endorsed and justified to the point of revolution. All of this goes back, as archetypes will do, as symbol typologies in their original ordering will do, goes back to the time of Jesus. It goes back to the first century BC, back to the first century AD. In that 200-year period, more or less, one finds the genesis of the emergence of Jesus and the echoing resonances to a harmonic of the fact of Jesus in his life. The first part is the expectation of what that figure will be, of the significance of calculating how that figure will be emerging and when and where. The archetypal way of expressing this is the three magi who come from the east, following the patterns of the star of the birth and knowing exactly where and exactly when to bring their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We three men from Orient are traveling, following the star. This star, this guiding star, occurs in its emergence historically before there is a Christianity. And that the emergence of a Christianity is fighting its way against a previous mythology, coming to be finally characterized as a pagan mythology. It is a pagan mythology that is cupped into acceptance culturally and communally by the old pagan kingdoms, going back to the pharaohs, going back to the earliest kings, coming right up to the Roman emperors, the Caesars, that fighting against the mentality of the order of culture and community by the Caesars, and also the expression of it, not only by the rituals that are cognate with the Caesars, but also the rituals that are cognate with a previous testament, the Old Testament, that one somehow has to break free of the Old Testament in a new way, seeing it as a different way from the now outmoded old way, and not so much destroying the Caesars as converting them, so that now the empire will be not the Roman Empire, but becomes, by Constantine's time, the Holy Roman Empire. One has converted the mentality, co-opted the culture, co-opted the community, and has transformed by seeing in a new light the way in which not only is the Old Testament read, but that the expectations of the new have also been codified in this new way, so that the occurrence then leads towards the conversion of the world that has been successful, and that this then is the message. This is utilizing a mythology as a confirmation of a mentality and that has been converted, and a ritual basis that has been reformed. So that the reformed aspect of it was actually called the Reformation. That on the heels of the Renaissance, and even while the Renaissance was still reverberating, still resonating, a Reformation comes into play. And the beginnings of the Reformation are the beginnings of the recovery of the ability to read Greek deep enough and well enough to make a new translation of the New Testament. And the first figure to really master this in a brilliant way was Erasmus in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And one of his first great works in 1516 is a new translation of the letter to the Hebrews. The closest friend that Erasmus had in the world was in England, in London, who was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, John Collett. And the two of them had a third friend who became, because of his brilliance, tutored even beyond both Erasmus and John Collett, C-O-L-E-T. That was Thomas More, Sir Thomas More, St. Thomas More. And so it's Thomas More, whose book on Utopia, it's Erasmus of Rotterdam, whose translation of the Epistle to the Hebrews, it's John Collett, who went to Florence, who studied under Ficino, who understood that the key to the maturity of the ancient tradition that was now revived in the Renaissance, the key to it came 500 years after the life of Jesus, at the close of a 500-year period, and that figure was Dionysius the Areopagite, that he was the mystical apex after a whole 500-year time cycle of the more transcendent cosmic meaning, the more deeper primordial meaning of Jesus himself, and his emergence as the presentation of God, the Son of God in the sense of being family inheritor. And that time was of the essence of the calibration of all of this, and Collett took back with him the Hermetic Renaissance of Ficino, just like individuals had done, like Botticelli, like Michelangelo, like Leonardo, Raphael, and on, Pico della Mirandola, a great list. And in London, as the dean of St. Paul's School, Collett began to fashion commentaries on the writings of Dionysius the Areopagite. And they became a model then for the new mystical, transcendent way of understanding the secrets of Christianity. But the mention of Dionysius the Areopagite comes in the letters, the epistles of St. Paul, which belong in the first century AD, between 50 and 65 AD, is when all of the letters and travels of Paul become conspicuous. And one of the hearers of Paul in Corinth is said to be Dionysius the Areopagite. It is in the beginning of 1 Corinthians, always cited as on a par with his letter to the Romans, as being one of the formative letters of the New Testament, the winning hand. And he mentions in his letter to the Corinthians that they have been divided into four different sects, four different ways of looking at Jesus. And one of them is from the way of Jesus. One of them is from the way of Peter. One of them is from the way of Paul. And the fourth is from the way of Apollos. Who is Apollos that he should be considered by Paul equal to Paul and Peter and Jesus? It's Apollos of Alexandria. And the first person to bring back the understanding that the epistle to the Hebrews is by Apollos of Alexandria and not by Paul at all, in fact, is a completely different understanding, is an understanding of Jesus and not an understanding of a Gentile church Christianity. And the first person to really be able to read Erasmus close enough and read into the Greek close enough was Martin Luther. And by the 1530s, he was able to recognize that Apollos is one of the most brilliant original thinkers. He is on a par with St. John and with St. Matthew as bringing the stylization and presentation of Jesus in his primordiality, in his historicity. And when we come back from the break, we'll take a look at how all of this was recovered in the Renaissance, reveiled by authority, both by the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. And when it was brought to the New World, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the Renaissance, all of these currents swirled together and produced in the early decades of the United States of America a quality of insight that had not been seen since the early days of the Renaissance, had not been witnessed since the first century AD, and that one of the figures who brought this out clearer and clearer was Emerson. And the figure that Emerson looked at, the man that he looked at, that presented this most pristinely to him was Henry David Thoreau. Let's take a little break and we'll come back. Let's come back to our Hermetic America. We're pursuing a very layered complexity that has an actual history, but that the history is kaleidoscopic. It's not linear, but it is a sequenced set of resonances around not individuals, but persons. An individuality will always be an integral of what our minds focus on in terms of an identification which matches up with correlations. The basic correlations are from the actions that we do, the ritual comportments that we have, from the existentials that are there in those actions, the world of things and the world of sets of actions, will be the basis of the correlation, of the equation, of the identification, that the center of that mental order will be considered my individuality. And in between that ritual and that symbol, equation of identification as an identity and what we do and what we have will be the experience process, more or less shaped by these liminals. The easiest way to think of it is a parenthetical, that experience, the mythic horizon, is cupped, is parenthetically brought into a representation of that identification of our individuality at the center of our symbolic thought order and its correlate in the things and actions of the world, of this world. Hermetic traditions exceed the identification of the individuality with the correlate things of this world and the correlate actions with those things in this world. Exceeded by a further dimension, and that dimension is one of vision. And that vision as a fifth dimension then, hermetically, the way it was spoken of classically, is that it is a quintessential transform. It is the dimension of the way in which an alchemy then works. It is a dimension of the way in which a cosmos reveals itself. It is the dimension of the beginnings of the love of wisdom, and that the love of wisdom leads to the emergence of a new self, not a self of individual, integral, exclusively, but a self that has a part of an individual integral. But it also has a proportion of something beyond that. So that now the person, the transformed individual, become a person, emerges out of the quintessential field of vision, which has transformed the four dimensions of space, time, of ritual, myth, symbol, and of the field of nature, and that nature itself has accepted the field of vision as something that is a complementarity with the field of nature. Now one has a new nature. Now one has the ancient way to speak of it, because one of the earliest literary traditions of speaking about this was from Zarathustra, from about 2000 BC. And the carriers of that tradition were always called magi, so that the three wise men who follow the star of the birth of Jesus at Bethlehem, the three magi, are late representatives of that magi tradition. And now they would say of the field of vision in that lineage that it is magical. It is of the magi. It is a magic, not a magic of manipulation of things or of actions, but a transform of the symbolic structure of the mind from a purely four-dimensional integral to a five-dimensional differential integral. So that what emerges now are forms that are not existential so much as they are ratioable. They have a ratio of integrality with differentiality. So that what counts now is not counting, but proportioning. And because the proportions are able to be scaled, they will have scalers, out of which now one composes not lines of argument so much, but music. So that the disclosure of who you are now is disclosed not about what you would say about your identity or your identifications, but what kind of songs will you sing? What kind of poems will you speak artistically? What kind of hymns would you make? And there are two groups that exemplify this in collectives. And we have to look at this just esoterically for a moment. Our species, Homo sapiens, are part of a whole group of hominids that go back quite some long time ago. The first hominids, Homo habilis, as Louis Leakey named them back in the 50s, goes back a couple of million years. And included in further developments, there was Homo erectus, there were Homo Neanderthalus, Homo sapiens, and just discovered a couple of years ago, Homo florensis on the island of Flores in Indonesia, little 3 foot high human beings, hominids, named for the island, Homo florensis. But Homo sapiens emerged, and DNA studies have shown conclusively that the Homo sapiens emerged about 190,000 years ago in southern Africa. And there was such a thing as a primordial Eve, because the Homo sapiens genome is passed on through the female, mitochondria DNA, which only women have. So that there was an Eve. There was a first woman, actually, of our species, Homo sapiens. But there was a transform of Homo sapiens about 50,000 to 60,000 years ago, where the mitochondrial DNA is of a striking different scalar. It has extra qualities to it. And one of the extra qualities that originally was with Homo sapiens is that Homo sapiens, more than any other Homo group, were sociable. They had sociality. They made communities easier and more expansive than any other primordial groups, hominids or preceding. One of the reasons for this is in the ancient wisdom understanding that while males make culture, females make community. The nature of the feminine is to shelter, to invite, to birth, to nurture, to care for, to make the community viable as an aspect of the whole way in which life then is lived. And not in competition to that so much, but the masculine is a culture venturing forth, the courage to go out, the courage to hunt, the courage to do the danger of going out, learning about weapons, learning about snares, learning about hunting together. Whereas the community, the feminine, is about gathering and about taming plants and animals so that they are a part of the environment of the community. These are our fields. We don't have to go out and hunt these tubers, these berries. We grow them. We don't have to go out and constantly jeopardize the survival by trying to hunt scarce game. We raise them here in the community. So that it's misnamed when we say animal husbandry. It's animal wifery. So that the community has a feminine tone, whereas the culture has a masculine tone, and they're able to interpenetrate in such a way that they weave. And what they weave is the fabric of the cultural community, which is expressed in its communality through language. And so a mythic horizon of language has a feminine quality to it and must be adopted by the masculine to be able to use it, and uses it not for the cultural purpose alone, but to sustain the fabric of the life, which is the weaving of the community and the culture together. When it comes to intercultural contacts, those different fabrics, if they're to get along, must find a way to weave something more, weave them in together. And of course, if you have them woven in where they are already established and you don't transform them, you get patchwork, you get a quilt. But where there is an expanded community context, where the culture now becomes a civilization, the fabric of the weaving becomes a complex weaving that already obviates the need for weaving patches into quilt work. You have a new kind of complex fabric. So that a civilization is of several orders different from what a culture is. It's not only intercultural, it's civilized. This goes back in a very peculiar way, because the first appearance of a modification of Homo sapiens occurs around 50,000 BC, and the first place that they show up is in the site of what today is Israel, in Palestine. Specifically, the area around Mount Carmel. Now, that area was inhabited for several hundred thousand years by Homo Neanderthals. But Homo sapiens first appeared there in that area around 47,000 BC, and the earliest complete skeleton comes from one of the caves on one of the canyons from Mount Carmel, and it's a Homo sapiens woman from about 35,000 BC. On the top of Mount Carmel, Neanderthal skeletons go back several hundred thousand years. One of the qualities of the Neanderthal skeletons there from that time period is that the bones are surrounded by an outline of pollen seeds, so that the body was literally covered with flowers in a burial, which is a ceremonial of a whole cycle and ecology 200,000 years ago, of an understanding that the death is not an ending, but is a blossoming forth into something else. So that already with Homo Neanderthal, there was a larger scalar than what we had assumed, that the limitations were not very much. And in fact, mitochondrial DNA studies by 2008 have shown that Homo Neanderthal genomes disclose a much superior mathematical ability than Homo sapiens. But about 47,000 years ago, emerges a new kind of Homo sapiens, a Homo sapiens sapiens. And the repeat is that it isn't just wise man, but it's man wise about being wise, can learn, and that the learning is especially tied not to the hunting, but to the weaving back of the hunting into the deepening of the community. And one of the signs that this happens, that there are Homo sapiens sapiens, is that for the first time in the world, we find art. We find sculptures. We find paintings. And the Paleolithic civilization of Homo sapiens sapiens goes back about 40,000 years in discovered finds. And what one finds there is the enormity of the mystery of the males who must go through an initiation of passing through what they conceived of as the experience of death in the hunt, and a rebirth back into a deepening of the community. And that the feminine symbols of this are those of the expansion and emphasis, like Venus of ancient Germany from 30,000 years ago, the large pregnant feminine form where the breasts are circles, the thighs are circles, the buttocks are circles, but a seventh circle is the womb. And that figure, that Paleolithic Venus, in the exemplar I'm speaking of, holds up a curved shell, a horn, that looks very much like the crescent moon. is not only like the crescent moon, but is obviously a curved horn, which is hollowed out. That curved horn can, for the feminine, hold the fruits and becomes a cornucopia. A cornucopia in the time ecology of lunar cycles, but can also serve for the masculine without the fruit in it as a cornucopia, as a horn which one can blow like a shofar, summoning the men to meet under the aegis of the community, nourished by the community that has raised their nutrition together and is ready to provide it without the violence, without the hunt, within a transform of the community where the search is for a better community. Thousands, tens of thousands of years later, in the Boston of Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and so many others, as we will see, it came out as a transcendental, ratioed ideal that men and women can form friendships. They can become friends. Not only can men have men friends and women friends, but men and women can be friends as well. So that the transcendental person now is a lens for a community which prizes a friendship woven between the two genders, between not only culture and the community, but the raising of culture to a civilization and the raising of the community to the entire world, to the planet. So that there is such a thing now for the first time, a recognition that we, if we are raised together and raise our children together in this way, and they raise their children, our grandchildren in this way, eventually there will be a population sizable of capable men and women who will be the living examples of a planetary humanity, of a civilization of the entire world. And that the beacon for this, the first light for this, the lighthouse that signals to all those out there wandering and wondering that here is a place where this is happening, first surfaces at the founding of Hermetic America. And of course, we've been showing how it begins with Benjamin Franklin, accelerates through Franklin's long life, gains another impetus with Jefferson and his communities, and now we're looking at Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller and a whole surrounding entourage of people who take it not only a step further, but take it a harmonic further. Yeah. In doing so, these new communities, these new hunts for not only a better culture, a transcendent culture, but a transcendent civilization, result in leaving the formal structures of institutions from before because they are limited to an individuality. They're limited to a rituality. They're limited to a mythic presentation, or representation is better. And we're experimenting, we're searching, we're building communities of the new. So that one of the characteristics of Hermetic America is not only transform, but the future as a future history. It's not a future history in that it is written that there is a recurrent design that just plays itself out, or that there is some kind of a plan that is stamped and inculcated and that there is not much we can do, but rather, on the contrary, there is everything that we can do if we do it together in weaving not only the new and the future, but because of its, in mathematics it's called recursion. Because of the recursion, the more that the future is created and remembered in this way, the more that the past becomes a new past. One now is able to see it with new angles of vision, and instead of it being in a geometry that one thought one had understood was its shape and its limits, one now sees it in its trigonometry of its functional properties, which then lead a further resonance to, just as geometry can transform once and become trigonometry, trigonometry can transform a second time and become calculus. One can learn to calculate, not in a derisive sense of just calculate. The derisive sense of calculate like that is measuring by counting based on ritual, based on mental doctrines and orders. But calculus is a transform already of the dynamic functions of possibility transforming geometries. There is such a thing as a differential geometry. There is such a thing as a higher trigonometry. There is such a thing then as calculus, which is first brought into play in history in the West by two figures at the same time, like a tuning fork, by Isaac Newton and G.W. Leibniz. Both of them bring it in together in the late 1600s, the late 1660s, early 1680s, in that generation. What was interesting was that Leibniz learned about the calculus from China. Jesuits in China had translated the I Ching into Latin, and some of the Dutch traders who were there in Indonesia had brought a copy to Amsterdam that ended up in the hands of the philosopher Spinoza, who the young Leibniz came to visit when he was only 20 years old, and in discussions with Spinoza, Leibniz discovered that this was a mathematical basis for a whole new kind of mathematic. And he wrote a monograph on the I Ching, which was republished in English translation by the University of Hawaii Press about 25 years ago. Newton came through it through alchemy, through the Western Hermetic tradition. And the reason why the Western Hermetic tradition and the Chinese Taoist tradition are siblings, go together, is that they are both mediated by the Mahayana, by the transform of classical Buddhism into the great way. That it isn't focused on the identity, the identification of the Buddha, but that is lensed by possibilities of transform by the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattvas do this. And of course, the great feminine Bodhisattva is Kuan Yin, who carries the cornucopia of the flowers, or sometimes just presented in a single beautiful flower. And she is the bearer of this primordiality of the transform to Homo sapiens sapiens. But that because there has been a transform, there is a possibility of a further refinement, a further transform. And part of the work that is being done here by myself for the last 40 years. is to show that that refinement is a refinement to a new subspecies, Homo sapiens stellaris, star wisdom man, human beings who are at home in the entire star system as a home, who live on the interstellar frontier quite naturally and quite consciously, both at the same time, and whose roots at coming to this have been continuous in the sense of resonances in sets building into a harmonic for the last 300 years. And that the home base of this has been the United States, with many Hermetic Americans as honorable Hermetic Americans coming from all over the world, but reaching a pinnacle, reaching an apex in the 1930s and 1940s, that roughly from 1933 to 1945, especially because of the immense crush of Nazi Germany trying to take over Europe and of the Japanese imperial military trying to take over Asia, the United States became the refuge of the creme de la creme of Europe and of Asia, and revivified the American tradition in such a way that in that 20-some year span, roughly 1932 to about 1950, Hermetic America revived itself in such a way that it literally leapt forward so massively, so far, that it became feared by competition like the Soviet vision, or it became emulated, or it became a subject of jealousy. And so the entire world shivered at the sudden burst of an America that was extraordinary. And right at the apex of this influence, of this expansion, of this jump in capacity in 1947, were two events that happened almost within several months of each other. One was on my seventh birthday. I was born October 14th, 1940. My seventh birthday was on October 14th, 1947, when for the first time, Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in a jet. And just a couple of months before that, the Roswell UFO crash produced wreckage from of species from beyond the star system. So that the late summer, early autumn of 1947 becomes an archetypal rock thrown into the pond, the ripples of which continue to grow and become almost tsunamis by 2008. That the quality of what we're looking at is not a history back then in some line, but of ways in which there are deep precursors, deep resonances, which if we understand, we are able to tune our persons to sing, to speak, to live in harmonics that are at the cutting edge of our maturity. We belong as a species already on the interstellar frontier. We belong in galactic spaces. We belong in dimensions beyond even the quintessential fifth dimension, because the development of a prismatic person is like adding another dimension, a sixth dimension. Because there is not only the field of differential conscious vision that can transform the four-dimensional world, but there is a prismatic lens, the jeweled person, who can recalibrate the transforms and apply them, can create exactly this, can remember exactly this, can create all of this, can remember all of this. And so that six-dimensional prismatic person, when they now, as a community, as a culture raised to a civilization, a community raised to a planet, are able to produce that rare seven-dimensional process known as kaleidoscopic conscious history. So that history now becomes something quite extraordinarily other from the way in which it was misconceived before in terms of a limited mentality. So that one of the things we will see is that the United States develops a whole new quality of historicity. And that while there are contributions, in Europe it's called history of ideas, early in the 20th century, and there are precursors late in the 19th and early 20th century in Europe, the writings of Delthy and several other talented historians. It is largely due to a massive transformed community of Hermetic Americans who engender this quality of a kaleidoscopic conscious historicity, able to look at the science of the cosmos in a completely freshened new recalibration. And as we talked about last week, it is not only the development of American astronomy that becomes astounding, but that it is Americans who first calibrate astrophysics. It is a German-born Hermetic American, A.A. Michelson, who first determines the speed of light. It is in Hermetic America that one finds for the first time the reweaving of a technology like the telescope, so that you have very quickly from one Hermetic American, George Elroy Hale, the development from a backyard telescope that he had as a boy in Chicago, the backyard abutting to the University of Chicago, he becomes a professor of astronomy and makes the first astrophysical spectroheliograph, and very quickly becomes a professor of astronomy, and that the University of Chicago builds the great Yerkes Observatory complex on Lake Geneva in southern Wisconsin. And within less than a decade of that, he's already planning the Mount Wilson Observatory of a 100-inch telescope, 150-foot solar telescope tower, and towards the end of his life designs the Palomar 200-inch telescope. And under his aegis at Mount Wilson, in connection with Palomar, is the work of Edwin Hubble, who develops the first atlas of galaxies, and for whom the Hubble telescope is named. And now, the genius of Hermetic Americans like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, one has an internet access to a planetary telescope in your own desk, in your own living room, that you can run the cosmos forward and backward to any time, any scale, and to inquire without limit, without confiscating authority, the largest context of being, of being real. We're going to come back next week and take a deeper look not only at Margaret Fuller, but at one of the most outstanding American Hermetic Americans, Louisa May Alcott, whose father, Bronson Alcott, was one of the founders of the Concord School of Philosophy, and who designed a school of human culture in the Masonic Temple in Boston, known as the Temple School, but whose little house in the garden built in Concord was actually a Nepalese Mahayana Buddhist temple. And it was built by Emerson and Thoreau and Bronson Alcott himself. But it is Amy Alcott, Louisa May Alcott, and her sisters who become not only Little Women, and a whole series of family friendship on the basis of community, but who wrote thrillers that are finally published for the first time in the 1970s, 1980s, that languished almost unknown because they were written under pseudonyms. And they're thrillers. They're metaphysical thrillers investigating the nature of women in a world that is sometimes extremely harmful for them, and that their response sometimes is to seek to control it subvertly or to get out from the victimization of it. And the writings of Louisa May Alcott are now being looked at fresh and anew. And next week, I will bring in some descriptions of her. She was born in 1832. She died in 1888 when her father, at 88, died the same year. They are all part of a community. Louisa May Alcott, Margaret Fuller, Thoreau, Emerson, Bronson Alcott, and at least a dozen others. But there are whole patches of communities in Hermetic America that are developing at the same time. In Philadelphia, in New York, in Virginia, and more in the West. Not only the Midwest, but by 1803, the West in Hermetic America meant all the way to the Pacific coast. The first survey of that showed that there was a primordial Indian America that was very much mysterious because it was a direct contact with the Paleolithic. Hermetic Americans learned by 1804, 1805, that they could become white Indians. It was an extraordinary experience. And the first figures literally were called mountain men. John Muir's phrase, "We would like in this fresh new land to have men to match the mountains." And women who build communities that match the heavens. More next week.